CliffCentral.com.
Thursday morning, CliffCentral.com. It is just after 7 o'clock. This is where we get stuck into the real meat of politics, society, crime, current affairs, all of the things you care about. And if you have one appointment in your diary every week, it has to be this. The Burning Platform, brought to you by Nando's. So it's very important this morning for me to give you a little bit of background on our guests. First of all, Canthan Pillay, who you're familiar with. Canthan, our returning champion on the... I can call you that, right? You're okay with that. I keep saying it every week, but you smile less and less as the weeks go by, huh? What do you think of that, Canthan?
Until such time as I'm no longer a champion.
No, right. Okay, good. So Canthan's here to talk about all the things that are happening in the world of politics and give us some opinion and some analysis from his point of view. But this morning we're also joined by Greg, and Greg Ardé is a writer. He's also someone who's been in the profession of journalism for some time, the former deputy editor of the Sunday Tribune and KwaZulu-Natal bureau chief for the Sunday Times. In his 30-year career in journalism, he's worked as political reporter for the Daily News, business editor of the Mercury, and for the South African Press Association in the run-up to the 1994 democratic elections. He's also written a really interesting book called War Party. This landed on my desk the other day. I thought, we've got to get this guy in. How the ANC's political killings are breaking South Africa. So I'll give you a little bit of background before we go to Greg. But in KZN, IFP-ANC warfare has morphed into an internal ANC battle that has created a monster of competing patronage networks. Comrades are killing each other for jobs and for tenders. Corruption, failed policing, and the Izinkabi hitmen of the taxi industry loom large within KwaZulu-Natal. He highlights South Africa's culture of blood in the book, and in a 2013 paper, researcher David Bruce counted around 450 political killings in KwaZulu-Natal since 1994. The problem escalated dramatically during Zuma's years in office. And in the book, Greg notes the history of violence in the province in the 1980s and early 1990s between the IFP and the United Democratic Front. So we'll get into the reads with Greg in a moment and find out what the book's all about. But Greg, welcome. It's nice to have you on the show. Thank you.
Thank you, Gareth. Thank you so much.
Congrats
and
on
Greg. Greg, I'm going to say last time I saw you, you had a lot more hair.
What a bastard. What a thing to start with. I mean, really. So Greg, congrats on the book. It's hard to get a book published these days, and obviously lockdown is not the best time to launch a book because people, I suppose in some ways it might be, you know, because they're at home and they have some time on their hands, but you probably would have had like a big release party, and you know, you would have had people there and you would have been able to make a little speech. But when did it actually hit the shelves?
So, Gareth, it was launched about 2 weeks ago on a webinar. So, yeah, different gig entirely, but it seems to have gained some traction.
Well, that's terrific. I hope it does very well. You've done a huge amount of research and work on this, and it's one of those projects that is not just about the last 3 months with a whole bunch of opinion ladled on top of it. It's this goes all the way back. And you've really got into some very dangerous places. So we'll talk about the details of the book in a moment. First of all, Canthan, any updates on lockdown and on the president and on the way that we're responding to coronavirus? I think I might have it, but I'm not going to jump to any conclusions, and I'm certainly not going to go for a test. I'll just stay away from other people.
You think you might have the update, or you might have the coronavirus?
I might have the virus.
Oh, okay. Well. No updates to speak of, other than the fact that there's been, for the first time, apparently serious lobbying behind the scenes on the part of the alcohol industry to try and get at least some portion of this overturned. But apart from that, they seem to be floundering on in their usual way. Greta seems to have recovered, which is a promising sign, because if someone with his girth can actually survive this, it means that there's hope for those of us who are... carrying, shall we say, less of a public burden around with us. Well, and I can see Mbulelo is cracking up at this point.
I said at this point that I don't believe he ever had COVID, and I have it on good authority because I know somebody who shares a bottle of the finest Scottish product with him often, that
yes,
his problem is around liver, not around the COVID or, you know, sort of anything like that. That is on record, and I'm happy to stick to that.
Okay, sure, but I'm just going to distance myself from your comments, Mbulelo, because I don't want
That's okay.
Gwede saying that, you know, I said he was an alcoholic, you did.
I stand alone, and I'm happy to go to the courts with that. So just
suppose so. But you know, Canton, you bring up the liquor industry, and I just want to address something here we've spoken about, but we really only touched on before. Is South African business are rather spineless. They keep thinking. There's that brilliant limerick. It's the only one I remember. There was a young lady from Niger who smiled as she rode on the tiger. They returned from the ride with the lady inside and the smile on the face of the tiger. And to me, that exemplifies the relationship big business think they have with government. They keep riding the tiger thinking, this is going to go fine. And then they end up being eaten, and the government comes back with a smile. And invariably, these people are caught between. I mean, I've had some communications with people inside the liquor business, and they're mostly afraid that their liquor licenses will be revoked. And that will obviously mean the end of their ability to trade. And my response is, well, then do it illegally. I mean, the illegal tobacco industry is doing a great job at the moment of distributing their product. Everyone seems to be smoking it. They're making tons of money. I think we're actually subsidizing more than we've ever done the Zimbabwean tobacco farmers in a big way. So why are you so worried about complying with the law when the people who make those laws are not your friends?
Yeah, let's just take a particular perspective on the way in which business is structured. Now, if you go all the way up to the very top of the food chain of nearly every single one of these companies, you will find sitting on the board at the in the upper echelons, someone who is in knee deep in the ANC's morass. And so you have that situation. Remember when lockdown first kicked in?
Yeah.
And suddenly e-commerce was shut down.
Yeah.
And Take A Lot CEO came out with guns blazing and wanted to do something about it. Mm-hmm. And then his bosses at Naspers came down from the top and they said, and now you're going to back down. So the rot comes from the fact that the ANC has infiltrated the upper echelons of business at almost every conceivable level.
But shouldn't these businesses kick those people out now, having identified them as their mortal enemies?
Well, remember what's happened. I mean, I don't know whether we talked about this last week, but basically the ANC took advantage of the lack of attention on the part of journalists to gazette amendments to the BEE laws, which will then allow them to determine the proportion of racial representation at every business around the country. So now if you take that as an extension, now we have a situation where you've had all of these people in the upper echelons of business basically saying, well, let's just get the ANC people on board. Mm-hmm. I think a starting point needs to be that if they are going to be enforcing black economic empowerment, they need to be pulling in some real shit kickers who have complete disdain for the ANC.
Right.
And that means, you know, pulling in the likes of Mbulelo, for example, who's not an alcoholic.
But this is a good point. So if they want you to bring in, you see, they're trying to get ANC people into the businesses, quite obviously. But what you need to do is hire black people who are not ANC people.
Correct. Yes. Yeah. You know, someone like Kusela Diko, right?
Right. Absolutely. Because she's only the president's spokesperson.
Yeah. But apart from that, trying to think of what other matters of significance came up. And we still don't have any word on how Ibrahim Patel is doing, because remember that he's the other person who is purportedly infected.
Didn't Tula Sinlesi also, he was hospitalized for coronavirus, but I think he's not as well.
Yeah, well, I missed that one. Let's park that. Other thing of significance, by the way, and I cannot recommend this strongly enough, there's an affidavit that Chief Justice Mokgweng has put out.
Mm-hmm.
Which deals with the entire attempt of Africa for Palestine to cancel him. And this thing is brilliant. I've got to tell you, it is a literary tour de force. At some point, as soon as I've got some free time later on today, I'll tweet some excerpts from it.
Forward it to me. That's great.
And I will forward it to you. But essentially, he goes on to the entire logic around cancel culture, goes into the historical perspective around it way before social media existed, talks about why the drowning out ideas is such a fundamentally bad thing. And more importantly, it is unconstitutional in the South African context. And brilliant stuff. And, you know, the Chief Justice and I disagree on a couple of things, but I've said this before, the man's integrity is really unassailable.
Well, that's terrific to hear, and I'm glad to see him doing that, because the one thing that you absolutely should not do is capitulate to these people. By these people, I mean the cancel culture people, the safe space, you know, those lunatics. Because the moment you give an inch, they take everything. And if you don't, if you want to actually have a respect and a position, you want to maintain any kind of liberty that you already have, the only way to do this is to fight back. And it's amazing how quickly they'll back down. They're not brave people, these the cancel culture crowd. All right, so.
They're not at all. Just one last thing, Bill. You know, heads up, the 1st of August, Joe Biden is going to announce his running mate.
Who do we think it's going to be, by the way?
Well, the rumor mill has, been trotting out Kamala Harris's name. I think it's a bit of a crapshoot, because at the end of the day, it's a question of whether Joe Biden actually remembers who his running mate is supposed to be.
I think if it isn't Kamala Harris, it's going to be someone who won't help him at all. And I don't know that she'll help him, frankly, because she's a narc. She's someone who used to be a prosecutor in California, and she's not widely loved. All it would do is tick the intersectional boxes, really. And I suppose beyond that, not very much. Okay, so we didn't bring Greg here to listen to us talk nonsense. Let's get him in. And Greg, tell us, first of all, because your book is the thing that I used to introduce you, just how how allied is the ANC to organized crime, and particularly these networks of patronage that we see? We know about Mpumalanga under Daweni Mahlangu all those years ago, and subsequently with David Mabuza, that there are networks there that are particularly dangerous, and being inside the ANC is almost more dangerous than being outside of it. But in KwaZulu-Natal, where you've focused a lot of your energies and interests, tell us how bad this problem is.
Sure. I think your comment was so apt there. It's more dangerous inside the ANC than outside the ANC. I think on a macro scale, everybody's well aware of the rampant theft, say capture et al. But I think the horror of where the ANC is going comes alive in KZN, in little forgotten towns where the ruling party is absolutely everything, and where it infests the day-to-day running of little towns, and completely paralyzes them. And in a way, the book is about the forgotten stories, and it's about the about ordinary people's lives just put on hold by the party's total preoccupation with control. Mm. It's really sinister. Corruption is a widely known story, but in the little forgotten villages where a lonely whistleblower is trying to do the right thing, it's quite a terrifying. It's quite terrifying.
So tell me about some of these little villages. Tell me about some of these places. I mean, small towns, villages, their economies have been completely hollowed out. The municipalities are not functional. None of them have had clean audits for the longest time. It's really just a trough where, you know, the food gets emptied into the trough, and the biggest, fattest ANC sows and pigs and boars come to the front, eat their fill, and then pass out around the trough so no one else can get near.
That's tragic. I mean, it's really tragic to go to these towns, because they were on the back foot before with general move towards the cities. And so there's like genuine deprivation there. And then to compound the misery, exactly what you've described takes place. Although, you know, the sort of heartening thing about the story, if there is a silver lining, is that you get these really brave whistleblowers and people who just sort of stay the course, and their lives must be really difficult. So it's like a prosecutor will just consistently do the right thing. A lonely cop, at peril to himself and his family, will doggedly keep on the case in spite of serious intimidation and threats. And it's pretty bleak, but there is that upside where it's like civil society is trying to claim a toehold, not let go.
Your book tells us about how people are being murdered. I mean, there is no respect for life here. If there's a tender up for grabs or there's some money left in the till, it is of absolutely zero consequence to some of these would-be politicians, because some of these people are at the very lowest municipal level. We're not talking about people who appear in the national parliament necessarily, although those people are sometimes as frightening. We're talking about low-level people none of us have heard of in Ladysmith or Newcastle. Or I read stories this week about Maluti Apofung, and I know that this is not in KZN, it's in the Free State, but that's Harry Smith, basically, which is just not paid its electricity bills. They owe 5.3 billion rand to Eskom, and Eskom has suddenly decided to attach their bank account. But it's taken this long for them to do it. I mean, we're talking about huge amounts of money, and we're talking about small-scale politicians, basically thieves and murderers.
Yeah, totally. And you can imagine if you're trying to do the right thing in those little towns. There's the book is full of little stories like that where somebody tries to do the right thing and they've got an avalanche of evidence against somebody, and then the key witness gets killed in broad daylight, and you can imagine how that affects the prospects for transparency.
Well, no one's going to come forward then, right?
Yes, it's terrifying. And then if somebody does, and the cop against all odds manages to arrest somebody, then a witness will disappear, or they'll suddenly go mum.
Let's just, Canthan, I know that there's a temptation here to be glib about these things and say, oh well, what did you expect from the ANC? But there are plenty of people who live in these rural parts of KwaZulu-Natal. It's our second most populous province. And these people eke out a subsistence living. Some of them depend on food parcels and on government welfare. But it doesn't seem that any of their interests are represented at the municipal, local, provincial, or national level. They're just left to their own devices. So essentially, they're living in an anarchy anyway, right?
Well, I don't really think it's a question of anarchy. It really is the feudal structure that goes to the heart of what exists primarily in KwaZulu-Natal. And that fundamentally ties back to the question, which we've talked about before, of land ownership. And when you have a situation where the ability to exert power over the masses comes from your ability to determine whether or not they have the right to live in a particular place, whether or not they have a right to farm whatever they want to, and so forth. If you fix property rights, and that means handing out title deeds so that people can actually start building a sense of wealth, you can start fixing the problem. But it really is as simple as that. Because all of the other things that we might try and do, they will always just be palliative. Greg, I don't know if you remember this particular story, but it was when Betty Taylor was still police commissioner, and he went into an Abiti, as in the Ladysmith area, and he called all of the warring factions together, and he said, "You guys are going to stop killing each other, otherwise I'm going to come in and kill you guys." And so for that period, there was a peace of sorts that kind of reigned out there. And then, of course, he got removed as police commissioner, and things went to hell in a handbasket at the same time. And again, like I said, it becomes palliative, So how do you have long-term fixes?
So every now and then, it's obvious that the cops have to have a show of force, or the authorities have to have a show of force. I'm not sure if we're talking about the same story, but in one instance, cops arrested like 140 taxi drivers and taxi bosses, and it looked terribly impressive. But it's, I get the sense that apart from some individual efforts, the cops are like a blunt instrument, So every now and then you have to respond, you have to be seen to be doing the right thing. But I don't think it's been unpacked. I don't think there's enough of a helicopter.
Let me ask this then, because if what Canthan is saying is true, and we have no reason to disbelieve this, because it seems like the most logical explanation, that we're dealing with a feudal system. Now, in a feudal system, if you have a good philosopher king at the top, There tends to be a compliance through the ranks all the way down. If you have some wicked King John at the top and the Sheriff of Nottingham, then what you end up with is people having to steal, people having to break down the system, people not believing in the institutions. But who is really in charge in KwaZulu-Natal? Is it so disintermediated that it is the local taxi association boss? Is it the King of the Zulu? Is it Jacob Zuma and his pervading influence over the area? Is it Pretoria? I mean, where does the authority come from? Because in any feudal system, it's absolutely shaped like a pyramid, and that authority has to come from somewhere. People won't misbehave if they know for a fact that someone further up the pyramid will have them have their ass handed to them by that person.
Gareth, the picture that you paint is quite alluring. I mean, it's the bully boys. It's the bully boys. So they might come in different shapes and forms. It might be a taxi boss here. It might be an anti-boss branch chairman there. It might be a chief. It might be a tough, crooked cop or something. The story's layered and nuanced, but you do want to simplify it. And I'd say it's the bully boys. If you have to say who's in control, it's the bully boys in different shapes and forms.
Well, you talk about this culture of blood in your book. Where does that come from? And when you say that, you obviously, and you must have been in danger also publishing some of this stuff, because it must be very unwelcome for it to be put in print by some of these people. What is this culture of blood?
It's actually Professor Paulus Zulu spoke about that. He called it the culture of blood. And he called it, that was part of his testimony, I think, before the Morani Commission. And so it's not as though violence isn't an issue of grave concern in KZN, but it's just like not consistently dealt with. Some valiant colleagues have gone and done these stories, but I think what I've tried to do is put it all together in an accessible format so that people are aware of, can process it. And it's sinister and it is scary and I don't know how it's going to play, but
well, for example, I mean, you talk about Zandile Gumede, right? Who her own supporters called a gangster mayor, like they were saying this while they were supporting her, as if it was a compliment. There seems to be like a real strongman stroke strongwoman affinity in KwaZulu-Natal. Why also did it seem to get worse under Jacob Zuma's administration, when he himself had brought the KwaZulu-Natal region under the ANC's fold, and where he was regarded as someone who did have authority and did have some power and did have sway in a quasi-feudal system?
I think it got worse because all of this was enabled on scale, and I think people got cocky and strutted around, and you've only got to see it, Gareth. You've only got to see it to sort of firsthand to appreciate it. I mean, everybody sees political gatherings or whatever. But I interviewed Morani, Advocate Morani, for example. So he's the guy who ran the Commission into Violence, and he just spoke with like, he was gutted when he spoke about how politicians' bodyguards go around just shooting into the air, and it's a show of force and intimidation and machismo,
right.
And that's the way it's done. And it becomes more and more enabled with every iteration of it, the huge cavalcade, that the dudes in leather jackets, it's like it's a totally macho culture that the ANC have nurtured, which is not to say that it's like absolutely universal. There are lonely voices in the ANC who have expressed, I mean, I quote some of them in the book, and they're seriously concerned about this militarization of society.
You talk about the Morani Commission. I mean, they published those findings. It was a huge report, but nothing ever came of it.
Well, totally. I quote Morani in the book as saying, he worries that the reports that he did just gather dust on some government shelf. Yeah, it's like, again, it's an apparently earnest attempt to do the right thing, and a lot of hand-wringing when somebody gets shot. But then it sort of peters out.
My God. All right. So basically, because I'm going to let you go after this. I think that we've all got to read the book. But basically, your understanding of the ANC, looking at it now, with a special attention paid to the kinds of stuff that you've written in the book about the structure of the ANC, how it works, how money flows, how authority flows, what the nature of power in the ANC is really all about. Give me your understanding of what this organization looks like once you've opened your eyes and peeled back the curtains.
The words that I have, Gareth, it's terrifying. You see these huge heavies, these taxi heavies with connections, obvious connections to politicians. They're just flexing their muscle. I mean, the other night there was a shooting in Greyville. I mean, I don't know if you're aware, Greyville's where the July where the sort of
race course.
Yeah. So that's
where I was born, guys. By the way, just
Yeah, Kenton, your hood.
Tell him about how horrible his hood is now.
So it's anyway. What 2 weeks ago, late one night, the cops come chasing. There's a shootout. Like right, this is in the heart of the city, as it were, and the cops cordon off the scene, and then these taxi bosses arrive and they just outgun the cops. And I spoke to one of the guys on the scene, and he said, like, they had to stand down. And the taxi, the association is run by a well-known family or whatever. And it's kind of what it portends. So that's the ANC have aligned themselves with power, what I called in the book power projects, real heavies, and the real heavies are holding sway.
Listen, good luck with the book. It's really, it seems to me to be a fascinating, if unwelcome, dip into what really happens in places like KwaZulu-Natal. And they're not unique in KwaZulu-Natal. I mean, I referred to Mpumalanga, but we don't have this in other parts of the country to the same degree. It seems to me that KZN is uniquely gifted with a particular kind of violence and desperation. Or am I wrong?
It's a culture of militarization that goes back to the days of Shaka.
Yeah.
And at that level, it is so deeply ingrained in terms of the way in which these structures actually end up forming. The thought just occurred to me, based on what Greg was just saying to us, is that you could probably think of the taxi guys in that part of the world as being part of a secret underground army that's really ready to be deployed at any minute. And of course, if one has to do a stop and search across all of them and check for the question of whether those firearms are legal or not, well, I think we can leave it to your imagination as to how many of them are likely to turn up as legal.
Probably the easiest way to move guns and money, yeah?
Absolutely, yeah. So against that backdrop, consider the fact that the police go out of their way to try and stop people from acquiring legal firearms, and there are constant court cases around that. It becomes scary. And I'm convinced that law-abiding South Africans really need to be trained in firearm usage and to actually acquire their own legal firearms. But that's a discussion for another day.
Well, no, I think we can have that discussion. Greg, thank you for joining us, and thank you for sharing your basic talking points about the book. But I think there's a lot that we've left on the cutting room floor here that is included in the book, and I would encourage anyone to pick it up and to take a look. Okay. War Party is what it's called, How the ANC's Political Killings Are Breaking South Africa. Obviously, I don't think it's going to be welcome at the dinner tables of heavy hitters in the ANC, but everyone else should be reading this. And Canthan, while Greg's making his way out, you did mention this SCA, I think that's what you were alluding to, the SCA decision on firearms, which was made recently, which basically puts every legal firearm owner in the invidious position of either becoming an illegal firearm owner or having to comply with legislation that means that they won't actually even be able to use their firearm at the moment for self-defense. This is something which is obviously untenable. And I know that you are a big proponent of legal firearm ownership. Why do you think it is so difficult for people who want to comply with the law, who are responsible citizens, to be able to comply with the law?
Because the fact is that government goes out of its way to make it as difficult as possible for people to legally acquire firearms. It's been the stated objective of the ANC for the longest time that the only people who will be entitled to carry firearms will be the organs of state, which is, you know, pretty much the way it works in most authoritarian systems. So it has been boiling the frog. There has been a steady chipping away at the legislative framework to make it as difficult as possible to end up having legal firearms in the hands of people. But at the same time, I think that, you know, one should take draw a distinction. Again, going back to your earlier point around the question of obtaining people who are making alcohol, selling it illegally, mm-hmm. based on the fact that government is depriving them of the right to do so. Mm-hmm. And I feel very strongly that there needs to be a mindset that we acquire that says we train as many people as possible across the board. You know, I would like a scenario where every single South African is actually competent in the use of a firearm, which is not to say that I want them to go out and get guns.
Yes.
But I do think that it becomes an absolutely essential skill, because if the ANC continues down this current path, the time is going to come very soon where we are going to be forced to defend ourselves against the fact that armed thugs are going to be knocking on the doors of the suburbs. And best we have some means of deterrence at that point.
Yeah, I mean, you can't rely on anyone else, right? It's better to have a gun and not need one than to need a gun and not have one.
Exactly. And but more importantly, you need to be able to know how to use it, and more crucially, when to use it.
Well, it's so ironic. I mean, we see this in America now, that the same people who are calling to defund the police are now arming themselves to the teeth, because they've realized that if the police are disarmed, that gangsters, criminals, and warlords are going to descend upon them in their droves. And now they've realized, oh, okay, so gun laws, the Second Amendment, not a bad idea. It seems very ironic to me that that's now the decision that the left in America have come to.
My 13-year-old daughter and I have been going through a period of deep discussion over the past week or so, because the overall theme that they are doing at her school is they're looking at India, and they're looking at it from the perspective of politics, of culture, of history, and all of those things. And I took her through, I got her to watch the movie Gandhi, for example,
right,
as a kind of starting point to give her the broad brushstrokes. And then proceeded to tell her how everything in there was pretty much spin to put forward a particular political narrative. But I took her back through to the history of India. And we're talking more than 2,000 years ago, to the time of the Emperor Ashoka.
Okay.
And what you will know about the Emperor Ashoka is that in the middle of the Indian flag, there's a wheel.
Yes.
It's a chariot wheel. And yeah, that's known as the Ashoka Chakra. And so it dates. It's a symbol that dates back to that time. But the Emperor Ashoka pretty much conquered all of India, mm-hmm. and then was taken to the field of battle by a Buddhist, saw corpses with blood overflowing on the battlefield, decided he was going to become a pacifist, and he disarmed the country. So he literally beat swords into plowshares.
Yep.
And he reigned in peace for a relatively short period, and a couple of hundred years later, the Muslims came rampaging into India, and they looted and pillaged and raped and ruled over the country for the next several hundred years until the British came along and did the same more efficiently.
And those plowshares were no good as defense mechanisms.
That, exactly, yes. Yeah. So again, I go back to the starting point. Trust in Allah, but tie your camel.
Yes, very good. All right, so I want to talk about one or two of the other things going on in the news this week. You mentioned already the presidency spokesperson, Kusela Diko, and her husband, who's a king of some kind, I understand. They've both issued a they've issued a press release, because that's what she does for a living, to say that their decision to get into business with the government was an error of judgment. They have issued this statement clarifying the circumstances surrounding the personal protective equipment scandal involving a company linked to the king and the Gauteng Health Department. And they've said, oh, what a terrible error of judgment. Is that good enough? Are we going to just allow her to carry on? Because this is what she's hoping for, clearly.
Well, just a couple of days before, we had the president standing, sitting and looking bleary-eyed at the TV and saying that we're going to root out all of these corrupt people. You know,
sitting right next to him, someone who was
sitting
involved.
Right next to him. Yeah. Why is she not being charged? I'm waiting for a reasonable answer on this. Of course, it's an error of judgment. And isn't that what all criminals say when they end up in the dock?
Yeah.
I'm sorry, Your Honor, I made a mistake.
Correct.
Well, of course, it's an error of judgment, but that error needs to be prosecuted and sentences need to be handed down. When is this going to happen? And the short answer is that Ramaphosa is incapable of doing so.
Well, apparently, according to them, the contract was cancelled before any money could be paid over. They say despite the absence of any illegality and the confirmation that no public funds were ever paid, details of which will be further ventilated by the investigations, the matter continues to draw outrage from across society. And so she must be, I mean, you know for a fact that these two discussed this in their marital bed at night and probably were wringing their hands thinking we're going to get away with 125 million of the South African taxpayers' rand.
Well, I'm not so sure about that. In political circles these days, do married couples still sleep together?
Yeah, that's also a good point. But let's not draw aspersions or come to conclusions about what their marriage is like.
No. It's not that there are any tigers in the ANC.
No, of course not. Let's talk about Public Enterprises Minister Pravin Gordhan and this IMF bailout, which I'm sure the ANC is celebrating from top to bottom and left to right, because it means there's going to be more put into the trough by the IMF. But people seem to think this is free money, Canthan. You have a daughter you just spoke of now. She's going to be paying off these debts well into her adulthood and possibly even her children into their adulthood.
Well, you see, the good news is in terms of the IMF loan is that the IMF loan comes at a cheaper rate than issuing another government bond. So, you know, if you consider that we are heavily indebted right now, if it's a toss-up between getting an IMF loan or Treasury simply issuing another government bond, mm-hmm. My money actually goes towards the IMF. Now, remember at the same time that this isn't the regular type of IMF loan. This is from the IMF Special COVID Fund.
Right.
So it doesn't come with the terms and conditions that would normally apply to an IMF bailout. So this is really kind of a safety net rather than a bailout.
But nevertheless, the point I'm trying to make is it's not free money.
It is not free money. But again, like I said, it's consider that we're currently paying in interest close to R1 billion a day. So if considering that the IMF money is coming at a lower rate than that, at very least, what does it translate to in rand terms? These billions have now been flying over my head.
About 7.5. You mean altogether?
No. The IMF.
70 billion rand.
Yeah. So well, that'll pay the interest on our debt for 2 months. So that's a good thing, surely.
Yeah, you see, when you look at it that way. But we're not talking about very often people. And, you know, Pravin and Tito are held up as these paragons of virtue by many people who say, oh, there's still good people in the ANC who are not stealing, who do understand economics. But honestly, do Pravin and Tito really understand the implications of having to pay back R1 billion a day in interest on our loans? And do they really understand what it means when they say things like they're going to, in inverted commas, mobilize funds for SAA, but they don't tell you how?
Well, the situation that we have right now, guys, let's look at it this way. All right. We have a situation where you're running a household, you have no income that's coming in, and your kids are about to starve. And so what do? You go to your credit card and you keep maxing out your credit card, and then you get another credit card to pay the interest on the other credit card.
Right.
And eventually you run out of credit cards to keep kind of cycling around.
Yeah.
But we haven't gotten to that stage yet, guys. Remember that we've still got the amendments to Regulation 28 in terms of the pension funds that's going to be coming down shortly. So there's still lots more money left to steal. So think of this as a stopgap. In the meantime, that's great to give people the ability to help themselves through more of our money. And, so at that level, you know, the IMF is giving us breathing space for those of us who want to move our pension funds out of the country.
Yeah, so in other words, get your money out as quickly as you can if you have any brains.
Well, not necessarily get your money out, but get it out of the pension funds. Again, we should get Magnus Hastick on the show, by the way, to talk about
this.
That's
a very good idea.
Because he brought this up about a month back. And the whole idea is that as long as your money is sitting in the retirement annuities, it is subject to Regulation 28. But once it's out of the retirement annuities and you've actually invested it into drawing a pension, you can then dictate where it goes to. So if government comes up with a regulation...
Aren't there penalties that come into play when you change from an RA to a pension?
No. Well, you see, you need to be able to take legal retirement. That's the point. So you need to be over 55.
Ah, okay.
So people who are able to benefit from it... I'm the only one in this conversation.
Yeah, so I'm basically, you're saying I'm screwed and that money that's in there is not mine anymore.
Yeah, well...
Thanks.
Yeah, pretty much so.
Great news. I spent a good 15 years of my life putting money away every month for this purpose, and now it's about to be taken away from me.
Well, think of it another way, Gareth. Go back to the start of the Zuma presidency. Mm-hmm. And at that point, if I take a look in terms of my pension fund holdings at the time, was sitting at just under 2 million rand. Now, if I had the ability at that time to take that entire 2 million rand out of the country and just simply stick it in a bank account in the US or in the UK or in Hong Kong for that matter, not earning any interest, you know, in fact, I could have been paying them a 1% a year to look after my money. Just in terms of the collapse of the rand against major currencies, I would now be sitting with close to 10 million rand.
Huh, coulda, woulda, shoulda.
Yeah, so, but my whole point is that most people are not thinking about the fact that the ANC has been systematically asset stripping the company, mm-hmm. based on the fact that the value of the rand has fallen and continues to fall. In fact, the fall of the rand under Ramaphosa, under the New Dawn, thank you very much, Peter fucking Bruce, is now at the stage where it's actually been the worst performance ever. Worse than it was under Jacob Zuma.
You just want to detail for people why you brought up Peter Bruce?
Yes, because Peter Bruce, more than any other person, was pushing us to actually support Cyril Ramaphosa.
I remember that. Mm. He's got a little bit of Stockholm syndrome, and I said as much on Facebook the other day, and he replied saying, just piss off or something. So he's obviously a little bit wounded.
Yes.
Yeah. I just want to move on to something else. We will get Magnus Haystack on. I think it's a really good idea. I want to move on to something else. Herman Mashaba has been making some waves in the last couple of days, and it seems to me that the zeitgeist is heading towards people like that who are on the outside of the tent pissing in. Herman Mashaba seems, with his open letter and his barrage of social media posts and his appearances on various shows, television and radio, he seems to be making some headway, and his message seems to be resonating with many people. Are we at all hopeful of Herman's chances of making a difference? And I don't want us to be cynical about this, because obviously it's easy to do that at the start. But do you think that there are probably a lot of people who will find a reason to sympathize with his position and where he may actually end up with a groundswell of support?
I don't know about a groundswell of support, but look, I think my view on this is that in the build-up to the next elections, mm-hmm. it's going to be entirely different to what we saw in the 2019 elections. Because remember that we have had a high court judgment mm-hmm. that has effectively said that individuals need to be allowed to contest the next elections.
Right.
And so there's a whole range of things that derive from that. We don't know what shape that's going to take, because remember that the high court has given Parliament 2 years mm-hmm. to amend the electoral laws so that we have a sense of how individuals are going to be allowed to contest the election. Against that backdrop, also, we need to take a look at what Franz Kronier said when he was here with us, mm-hmm. which is their projections, which have been spot on for the past decades, show that the ANC will drop to below 50% in the next election. So at that level, the more voices that we have that are pushing a narrative that is counter to what the ANC is and the EFF are pushing, because the alliance between those two is inevitable. Mm-hmm. Trust me on this. The more people we have chipping away at that ANC edifice, the better it is. So at that level, I do think that Musi Maimane is certainly going to acquire some chunk of votes, a couple of seats. I think that Herman Mashaba will probably acquire some chunk of votes. Certainly a couple of seats out there. And really, the more of more South Africans that we have that are actually pushing a narrative that is different from that of the ANC, the better it's going to be for us. So I don't think that you're going to see a groundswell that comes out from Herman Mashaba. Certainly those of us who were fans of him in the beginning, I count myself among those ranks, because remember, I said I voted for Herman Mashaba because I thought that he would clean up Johannesburg.
Yeah.
And remember, it was literally pick up the trash, fix the potholes, fix the traffic lights. And he didn't do any of those three things. And he had the opportunity to do so. So at that level, do I trust Herman Mashaba's ability to deliver? No. But do I think that Herman Mashaba sitting in Parliament and calling out stuff that the ANC is doing, would that be useful? Absolutely. Mm. So the people that end up voting for Herman Mashaba are very likely to be the type of people who refuse to vote for the DA because they believe that the DA is the party of apartheid, because that's a lie that they've been spun over the years.
Mm-hmm.
But it's all good. So is it important at this stage right now? I think there's too much noise going on. There's lots of people shouting against the ANC, but we are effectively powerless to do anything. Now, the point that many people have made, that really what the DA should be doing at this point is actually publicly defying the ANC in the Western Cape.
Right.
To say we run this province and we are not going to allow you to come in here and dictate how we are going to manage the safety of our citizens around this pandemic.
Right.
And there will be a groundswell of public support there, and that becomes a legal precedent. But again, the DA itself is tearing itself apart. They are practically rudderless at this point. And so we're unlikely to see anything emerging from them.
Yeah.
Until such time as you have a coherence in terms of the vision and the leadership.
All right. But you see, this is the question I'm asking you, because you have been quite vocal, and you have, over the course of the Burning Platform, where you've been our kind of main, what can I call you, our main co-host, you've indicated that you like Herman, you like what he stands for, but you don't think he can deliver.
Yeah, that's pretty much, well, I liked what he stood for. There,
right.
there are some things that kind of came completely out of left field, because, you know, his sudden focus on xenophobia, for example, was something that, you know, made me just, just the whole idea of calling out immigrants.
There was an email I got from Tobile a little while ago about how he thinks that we overreact to this wokeism on the left, and he says that these people will basically destroy their own credibility, and he says we should allow them to carry on being stupid, because what it's going to do is pass votes to the right. There is something going on in America that we've got to refer to at the moment. You mentioned Joe Biden and how he's choosing his running mate in the next few days. But with all of this madness that's going on in Portland, Oregon, and in Seattle, Washington, and we see, you know, increasingly the left doing things to almost self-sabotage, there are people in the middle, the moderates, if you will, who would go either left or right, but they're really looking for the least offensive person. Now, Donald Trump is very unpalatable to some people. And Joe Biden doesn't look as unpalatable as a person, even though he's half dead. Do you think that the left have done enough to piss off the people in the middle, that they would consider voting for Donald Trump, unsavory as he is, rather than stick with the Democrats?
There's a couple of interesting things if we use the U.S. example. Firstly, you have lots of surveys right now showing that Joe Biden is running ahead of Donald Trump.
Not just ahead, way ahead.
Oh, yeah. So that's the first interesting point. The second interesting point is that if you take a look at Fox News with Tucker Carlson, it has recorded the highest ratings ever for cable news in the United States.
Hmm.
So his shows are pulling something like 4.3 million viewers live.
It's phenomenal.
Now, this has never happened in the history of news.
No, consider that someone like Trevor Noah is getting like a couple of hundred thousand a night.
Yes. So now you've got 4.3 million people tuning into Tucker Carlson. And at the same time, you've got a survey that's come out, and I forget the exact source. I'll have to dig it up. But it was certainly it was statistically significant, that showed that the overwhelming majority of people in the United States are afraid to freely express their opinions.
Right.
Because of the fact that there is cancel culture going on right now. So if you combine those bits of information, on the one hand, you have people saying that Joe Biden is ahead. On the other hand, you have people looking for news sources that are quite definitely against the narrative that is being put out by everyone else. Because consider that Tucker Carlson pulls in a bigger audience than CNN, NBC, ABC, all of those guys combined.
Yeah.
So
that must be some kind of indicator.
Yes, yeah. And so if one reads between the lines out there, my take on it right now is that Trump is going to walk through this next election, just based on reading between the lines. But also it comes back to something else that I tweeted earlier this morning, where I said these whole distinctions of referring to people as left and right has become just so meaningless.
Yeah.
And we really need to stop using this terminology, I think, because the truth of the matter is that let's be very clear about it, because they fundamentally support the same thing.
Yeah.
Okay. They support race-based politics. They support the rights of some groups over the rights of other groups. They believe in authoritarian states, all of this type of stuff. And the people who sit in the middle, as we refer to it, are people that generally have reasonable views. And if I use myself as an example,
you're not a reasonable person. Don't be silly.
Well, let me put this in perspective. Okay.
Okay.
All right. On some particular points, I'm against the death penalty, for example.
Right.
Which is very firmly considered to be a position on the right that you have to be supporting the death penalty.
Right.
I'm very much pro-choice, okay, which again
is a left position.
Well, is it a left position?
It used to be that it was liberal, that it was about
it's a libertarian position. It's a libertarian position because it actually emphasizes that the individual has a right to determine, and the state should not determine on that person's behalf.
Right.
I'm a supporter of gay rights. Again, why? Because it's a question of individual liberty. You have the right to associate with whoever you want to. Mm-hmm. But at the same time, do I believe that, kids who are not yet legally able to have sex should be given hormone blockers because they believe that they want to be Princess Diana? Absolutely not.
Yeah.
Now this is where nuance comes in. Because, the whole idea is that if you are against giving hormone blockers to kids, then you are against LGBTQI plus whatever other epithets they tag on to the end of it. I think that lots of people actually have very reasonable views this way. And our Chief Justice's affidavit in terms of his views on Israel, again, another classic example of this. He's saying that the Bible entreats me to love my neighbor as myself. So how can you expect me to hate Israel? And I like to think that this is a reasonable viewpoint. Well, and it's neither left-wing nor right-wing.
A friend of mine says, I think you lose the moderates around the signpost on your highway that says stuff like, my husband is pregnant.
Was that a real thing? All right.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. Well, I mean, it's figurative, but you get the point.
Yes.
No, there was a show on Oprah about that, to be clear.
Right. Okay. But again, guys, let's be very clear about this. Do I have a problem with your being born a biological woman and deciding to call yourself a man? No, I don't have a problem with that.
No.
Do I have a problem with you're now saying that legislation must be amended so that you are able to actually go for a prostate exam?
Forcing me under penalty of being charged with a crime of having to refer to you as X, Y, or Z. In other words,
exactly right.
In other words, making your fantasy narrative a legal reality. That just seems a step too far for most people.
So, absolutely.
In other words, you're saying that the majority of people, the silent majority, again, to coin a phrase which people use too often, of people are quite happy to be as liberal as they need to be or as conservative and traditional as they need to be, but they just don't want the predations of an overwieldy, perhaps too authoritarian government, especially in places like the United States, where that's exactly what they fought against in 1776.
Well, that's exactly right. And if you look in terms of almost every measure in terms of the advancement of human rights in the Western world, there has been massive progress made on every single front. You know, just consider that during the Obama presidency, gay marriage was illegal. Mm. Can we just remember that? That's as little as, what, 10 years ago?
And in fact, Obama himself at the beginning of his first term was very much against gay marriage.
Absolutely so. So we continue to chip away. But the point at which you insist on shoving things down people's throats instead of allowing reasonable people the opportunity to actually make up their own minds in terms of the extent to which they want to personally engage with such discussions.
Yeah.
That's when things actually fall apart and you have a backlash. Bolelo, you look braced to actually...
Before we let you go, sorry, Gareth, I know we're running out of time. I just wanted to finish off on our theme for today, which was violence from the state. And I was speaking to somebody this morning who spent the last 20 years working in war-torn Africa, throughout Africa, and dealing with violence. And she said, look, if you want to know what type of government you're dealing with, always look to the type of violence they're impressing on the society. So I wanted to know in your part, and she then finished off on a poignant point, is if you are to have hope of that ending, you need to look to the well-to-dos and their appetite for violence against the state should it come to that. In South Africa, do you think our well-to-dos, and that includes all of us on this call, have that appetite should it come to that? Because for true change to happen, tragically in recent history, it often comes to that crux, right? Do you think we have the appetite for violence should it come in the next decade or so? I'd be interested to hear your points.
Remember, the question of the well-to-do in our country is very different from the well-to-do north of the Limpopo. So,
fair enough.
So the truly well-to-do in our country already have their wealth outside the country. Then you get to the initial part of the conversation that we had on today's show, where we were talking about the likes of the big corporates, which have the ANC sitting on their boards. And they are the people that really have the financial wherewithal to actually go head to head with the government. The rest of the people that...
But no stomach for it.
Yes, but no stomach for it. The rest of the people that you and I might think of well-to-do are really middle class in the grand scheme of things, who are literally 3 or 4 paychecks away from homelessness.
And do you sense that they already, for the proverbial and literal guillotines, should it come to that?
I think that that most of them are actually voting by leaving the country.
Mm.
And if you look in terms of the exodus of people from this country, it is from the middle class. Mm. And I think that that is going to be the way in which it happens, that as many people as possible who have the ability to leave the country are going to do so. There are those like me who, you know, I ran away from the country with the state of emergency in 1986, and I came back in 1994 to build something, and now I'm in a scenario where damned if I want these thieving blackguards who rule over us to take it away from me. Hmm. But is that the type of mindset that my kids need to have? No, absolutely not. The world's their oyster. They need to be able to go pretty much wherever they want to, and I think to a large extent they will end up doing that. And I think that most of the middle class in this country right now is taking that particular view. So it's very different to the likes of places like Malawi, for example, or South Sudan.
Sure. All right.
Well, I'm afraid, gents, that's all we've got time for today. It was good to have an extended little period with Canthan this morning, and thanks to Greg Arday for joining us. His new book is called War Party. You need to see it. It's about the ANC and particularly the political killings in KwaZulu-Natal. Thank you all very, very much for joining us this morning. The Burning Platform is brought to you by Nando's. CliffCentral.com.